it'll come up later.
Right. What a cold open.
Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Genrecast. We gather around a table, we discuss the films you'll never discuss in a film space course. This week's film is Joint Security Area by Park. Wait, Chan-wook. Yeah, I was like, I always Chan-wook Park, Park Chan-wook. That guy is making this. And so we continue the song of praise with that. I am still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I am still Dalton, although I am not allowed to enter certain borders unless I have an authorized escort.
And this week we have a guest host. Sir, who are you? Identify yourself and where you're from and all that good stuff.
Hi, I'm Caleb Masters. I think I'm still Caleb Masters, last time I checked. Hello, friend. It's good to be with you again.
Yes, you could absolutely say the still. You can use that adverb because Caleb was a regular co-host on the Good Trash Genrecast back in the day, and we are thrilled to have you here with us talking about Park Chan-wook's excellent film. I think excellent, maybe excellent. We'll discuss that in a minute.
Should stand.
Joint Security Area. I had fun, but we'll talk about that. In case you're tuning in for the first time, though, friends, this is not a review show. It is an analysis show. So although I will tell you how much I like this movie, and the rest of my co-hosts will, that's not what we're all about doing here. We're going to do analysis, and that does mean spoilers. So what we'll do is we'll do that review part early in the show for just a few minutes. We'll have a synopsis, a quick set of thumbs up, thumbs down reviews from the four of us, and then we move into a little mental exercise called expanding the syllabus, which will involve gentle spoilers. And then we'll have some kicking music to let you know that we've gotten down to business. And that will be when all spoiler bets are off. You have been warned. Without any further ado then, Mr. Arthur Gordon, do you have a synopsis for us today?
Somewhere, yes. Let me see.
I believe in you.
Thank you. Yes. In this very special Patreon-sponsored episode, thanks, Keithan.
Yes. Thank you, Keithan.
We're talking Joint Security Area. Following the murder of two North Korean border security soldiers, a neutral investigator from the Swedish embassy is brought in to investigate all sides without bias. They know the who and the what, but not the why. Yet, as the pieces fall into play, the puzzle becomes more complex.
All right. Yes, that is the movie. Correct. I have no reaction.
Now, hold on, Arthur. I'm getting the vaguest feeling we talked about this movie on the show before, and I think Caleb was with us when we did it.
Look, I want... hang on, let me see here. I want Major Sophie Jean on that wall. I need Major Sophie Jean on that wall. Yes, it is kind of a Few Good Men, but... South Korean.
Kind of, yeah. Something else. Yes.
It's definitely adjacent, but yeah, I think it, and maybe I'm revealing my hand now, I do think it reveals more layers than that.
I think it's not just the story you're telling, it's how you're telling it. So the plot thickens.
Yes. Yes.
A Few Good Demilitarized Zones is the subtitle to the film. So good times. Well, let's go. I'm going to go first to our guest host. Why are you here for this particular episode, and what do you think of whatever the name of the stupid movie is, Joint Security Area.
So, yes, I don't worry, Dustin. I, too, have struggled to actually say the title of this name correctly. It's like every time I want to say it, it's totally gone. But Joint Security Area, I really like this movie. I say this every time I see a Park Chan-wook movie. Like, he just blows me away. And I know that this movie certainly is pulling from a lot of very familiar tropes, but I think it's really exceptional in how it does it. I actually went into this movie with pretty much no knowledge of the plot whatsoever. And I actually thought it was going to be about something totally different. Even in the first scene, I was like, okay, this movie's about it's about something totally different. And I thought the twists and the turns and the way that they chose to, I would say, like, reveal certain plot details really kept me on the edge of my seat. And again, the cast is fantastic. Song Kang-ho, of course, is a Parasite fame, is a scene stealer. But I'd really be remiss if I didn't mention, again, apologies if I get this name wrong, Kim Tan-woo's outstanding performance as the South Korean soldier of focus. And I also really, really liked the cinematography and editing style. I think both of these are really, really strong elements here. I think there's some very stylish decisions that the camera was done with the camera work and also the editing that still feels pretty fresh and stylish despite being 21 years old. So I am a fan. That said, you can't deny that there's certainly quite a bit of you could say military. What would you call it? Like military investigation film tropes that work their way in there.
Very good. Very good. Thank you very much for that, Mr. Caleb Masters. Hey, Dalton.
Yeah.
What do you think of this movie?
It's good. Yeah, I like it. It's fine. Everybody in this has been in better movies. We talked about a bunch of Song Kang-ho movies last year, and I do unfortunately think they're all better than this one, but that doesn't mean this is bad. It's early on in everybody's career. They're still getting their feet under them. I think there is an artist's eye and an artist's interest at play here, right? This could be much more conventionally told, and I'm not trying to throw Reiner or Sorkin under the bus too much, but that movie's pretty conventionally told. It feels like an adaptation of a stage play, whereas this is just jumping all over the place. Without spoiling too much, our knowledge base as an audience viewer shifts a lot throughout this film. At certain times, we have as much information as the investigators, and then about halfway through the movie, we get as much information as the investigated have, just as the investigator is learning that. And we learn all this information through very lengthy flashback sequences, and I think that is really the strength of the movie. I at first was not sure how I was going to feel about this technique, this way of unfolding the narrative of the movie, because we do it at least twice, I think maybe even three times. But we cut to prior events, and each time we cut to prior events, it's for longer and longer amounts of screen time. And I was really surprised at how much I appreciated not only what that gives us as far as context for the emotional stakes of the film. I think I appreciated the way in which it reframed what we had already seen. The reason that these flashbacks work, I think, other than these kind of thematic and emotional beats I just mentioned, I think we got to give credit to the editing. There's some really great edits throughout this movie, and just whether it is using a transition to the next beat, using like a thematic juxtaposition to say something. I think specifically of a moment where we cut to the tourists, like right after it's either an autopsy scene or a flashback of the shooting. There's a pretty visceral and emotionally intense scene, and we immediately cut to American tourists just kind of bumbling about the DMZ. And there's a lot of stuff like that I think is really, really super effective. I was shocked at how much of a hangout movie this legal military thriller ended up being, and I was there for it. I really appreciate it. Caleb already shouted out the actor who plays Nam, who I thought was really good. I haven't seen him in anything before, but the character Jiang, who's played by Shin Hye Kyung, I've thrown a real dart at the wall on that one, but he showed up in The Foul King for a little bit, I think, and then Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. So we saw him in our marathon about Song Kang-ho's career earlier last year. He showed up and was very happy to see him. He's great as sort of this deeply sincere member of the North Korean border security. And again, Song Kang-ho kind of being this steely-eyed veteran. I did probably far too much research on North Korean military engagements, trying to find out where he would have served. I'm probably on a watch list again because of research for the show. I unfortunately could not figure out where Song Kang-ho's character might have served. But when a nation throws that large of a chunk at its of its GDP at the military, you can only assume they end up all over the world training other people, right? That has to be a thing that they do. Anyway, whether the backstory for that character is realistic or not, he totally sells it, which I thought was interesting. Again, this is an early film in his career, shortly after, or maybe even the same year as The Foul King, which is, the same year. Obviously much more comedic. So to get to see him at the same time of his career, get to do a much different character with a lot more emotional baggage, a lot more kind of like heady material going on. It was really interesting. I hadn't seen the lead, the Major Sophie. I hadn't seen her in anything before, but I wish that character had more to do, but I think she is deployed effectively for the sake of the narrative, but it really does become a movie that is more kind of hung up on the intricacies of the relationships between the people at the central, the people involved in the central crime, if that makes sense. So that character does unfortunately kind of fall to the wayside for much of the film. But I think from a screenwriting point of view, it finds a clever way to bring her back into the story and to kind of relieve her responsibilities. And we'll get more into that in a little bit. Yeah, good performances, interesting edits. And as Caleb, you mentioned some of the visual flourishes already too. I can't stop thinking about the owl that we get to see a couple of times, seeing the initial crime from an outside perspective, just like really small, kind of clever ways to get us into not only the happenings of the movie, but also just kind of its vibe. I love it. There's a lot going on here. It is, again, kind of across the plate in some regards, but I think the ways it finds to elevate itself are really, really interesting.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for that, Mr. Dalton Stewart. What do you say, Arthur? What is your opinion on Joint Security Area?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I really did. I thought it was a solid. I'm probably warmer on it than Dalton. I think it's a really solid movie. I have probably a similar opinion to this as I do of Searching, in that I think it's just a high level procedural, you know, episode of TV. You know, I think it's in that same space as Searching in some ways. I like. I'm not going to say too much because both Caleb and Dalton have spoke pretty well to the editing and visual style of this movie. A lot of great shots that I love. Just some really cool moments and bits. There's a thing with a window that's really fascinating.
That one's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I love the visual style here. And I like the little bits that we just don't get in Western cinema. There's that thing in the, when they go to the morgue and they flip the bodies over and they're just hard pressed. Right. Because rigor mortis is set in, so they're just like flipping them over and their bodies are just compressed from laying against the solid ground. And those little bits of detail like that, that we just never see in Western film, are really fun. You know, that being said, I think a lot of Park and his films, and the few that I've seen, I haven't seen all of his, but I've seen a handful. I've seen, you know, the Vengeance trilogy, and I've seen this, I've seen Stoker. So I've kind of seen a spectrum of his films, and there's really two, I think, Park Chan-wooks. There's a restrained Park Chan-wook who is still very stylish, but there's also a overindulged, convoluted.
Yeah, the full operatic treatment, right?
Yeah, and I think this is the Park I prefer, this much more stylishly reserved version that we get here in Joint Security Area. I would go to this any day over Old Boy. I think. And so that's, you know, something I've noticed about him, or Stoker. I think Stoker's in that same vein, is very restrained, very visually compelling. And so he's an interesting director, and one, you know, I haven't seen a movie I've, you know, disliked from him. I've liked everything I've seen, some more, much more than others. And so that piece of the puzzle I like. You spoke highly of the cast as well. I can't agree with you more. I do think that the weakest link are the two white guys, the two Swedish actors.
Oh, they're really bad.
Yeah, they're very awkward. They're very wooden. Yeah,
they're terrible.
So, but everybody else is doing a great job. And you know, we've kind of hit on it, but a lot of this cast works again with Park, right? We've already mentioned Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. Sophie Jean Lee Jung-ae is also in Lady Vengeance, in the third part of that trilogy.
Oh, okay.
So there's some really fun stuff there, and she's great. I really do appreciate her. And I quibble a bit with Dalton because I don't really think it's her movie here. And so that character, I could see why you'd want more because she's good. But it really is about that relationship between the two borders.
Totally. I guess I hope that didn't come across as too much of a ding against the film admirer. I guess it's more I got surprised by that aspect of the film, because you're totally right.
Yeah.
I think the film kind of reveals that it's not her movie, and I sort of did not expect that reveal.
If I could weigh in there too, I think just to echo Dalton's sentiment there, like I mentioned in mine, like I thought it was a movie about one thing. I thought it was going to be her movie about uncovering the truth, but that's not really what it was about. But there was a good minutes. There was a good 20 minutes where it really felt like that was what it was about.
This movie is as if A Few Good Men introduces Tom Cruise and then completely becomes a movie about the soldiers that he's there to uncover the murderer of.
It becomes Kiefer Sutherland's movie.
Yeah, exactly what happens here. But I think it's an interesting structure, and it's broken up into three chapters, each titled after the movie in reverse order, which I think is interesting. Area security joint, so that's fun. But I really do like that story that unfolds in that second act and that relationship that's built between the characters. So overall, though, I'm positive on this. I did enjoy it. It wasn't a game changer for me, but I do like it. So I'm warm on it.
Very good, very good. Thank you very much for that, Arthur. What do I like about A Few Good Rashomons? I mean, that's really what it is. It's A Few Good Men sort of meets Rashomon, sort of. Not exactly, but close enough. We sort of hear different versions of what happened, and we get to visualize those various versions, and then we come somewhere closer to what actually happened, which is unlike Rashomon. In that extent. But as everyone has said, well performed, well acted. I do like the editing. I do like the visual style. I do prefer Song Kang-ho in some of his other work. I do prefer Park Chan-wook in some of his other work. But that being said, this movie is very, very okay. It is extraordinarily all right, is my official opinion of the movie, and I had a lot of fun watching it. And so as far as a bit of media entertainment for a little over an hour and a half, it does what it needs to do, and I am glad that I watched it. So those were our thoughts generally, pro dear listener, regarding Joint Security Area. Moving right along to this little thought exercise that we do called Expand the Syllabus. Arthur, can you tell the dear listener what Expand the Syllabus is all about?
Surely I'll figure it out one of these days. So for the next several moments, we're going to sit around and discuss how we would use this film in a film studies course or another academic course. We'll also highlight texts that we would use to supplement it or highlight themes or elements from it. And that is expanding the syllabus.
Very good, very good. That is exactly what it is. I want to go to you first, Dalton. What does your syllabus look like there, buddy?
Well, the name of the class is Some Borders, Some Masters, an exploration of stories and friction. We're talking about borders, places that bump up against each other and the complications that creates for the people that live along those places. We're going to get a little bit more spoilery now, as Dustin's alluded to. This film does kind of end up fundamentally become about the wound that is the DMZ and the kind of psychological baggage that comes with this history for the people of the two Koreas, being born into a war that happened before their time and having to find allegiances based on their the geography of their birth. And I think there is a lot of really interesting stuff going on here, both in terms of like exploring how different upbringings and different cultures create different people, but also how there is sort of an unshakable, you know, unity of like, because we're from the same peninsula, we you just have like experiences that are wholly unique to us, right? Despite our different circumstances, there is something that we, the four people at the center of this crime, understand that maybe other people can't. And I tried to pick some films that did similar things with it, their tales of being on borders. So we're going to get the U.S.-Mexico border out of the way real quick. And by real quick, I mean get the drug stuff out of the way real quick. We'll do Sicario, we'll do Traffic, and we'll do the documentary Cartel Land from 5 or 6 years ago now. I think all of those films are good. I think all of them have their own failings, and I think they all have something interesting to say at the very least about what has been going on for the last 30 or 40 years or so. But I think we should also take a look at something like FX's The Bridge, which is, of course, you know, an adaptation of a Scandinavian joint about a body on a border. This one starring Damien Brashear and, oh gosh, I can't think of her name. The German actress who works over here a lot. She's in it too. She's good. Good show. Only went 2 seasons. I don't think I've watched the second, but I know I watched the first. And I thought its exploration of the theoretical whodunit of a body directly on the border is good. And obviously we play around with that idea here in joint security area. But I think the bridge gets at the, of course, because it's a, you know, a long form narrative. I think more than Sicario and Traffic, it can kind of explore the realities of life on a border in ways that are, I think, are really interesting. A film I haven't seen, but definitely sounds worth looking at for this class is Park Sang-ho's 1965, The DMZ, which is tells the tale of the devastation of war through the eyes of two children who are left in the DMZ after the end of the Korean War. Sounds sad, but sounds useful in a class exploring not only borders, but of course we're going to be looking at joint security area. I think it's helpful to have some context on the history that brings us to this fictional story. I also want to look at a film called 71 about the troubles in Northern Ireland. Jack O'Connell, is that actor's name? The bad boyfriend in Midsommar. You know him, you love him. Well, he was in this movie called 71. It's good. I like it quite a bit. I've only seen it the once, but I think it has a pretty okay track record in its runtime of using a very real, very unhealed wound to tell a, you know, behind enemy lines, dude has to run for his life type story and still finds the nuance in those moments. Also just wanted to bring it up because apparently things are heating up back over there again, which is unfortunate. You know, when things go unresolved, they do tend to reignite. I also want to look a little bit at the comic book DMZ that tells the story of the fictional Second American Civil War and the Manhattan demilitarized zone that is the center of the story. Apparently, Ava DuVernay has shot a pilot for a miniseries for HBO Max. We'll see when that happens, but I guess they took it directly to a short season order of four episodes. But the comic book, I've read quite a good deal of that it's run. I really strongly recommend you check it out, honestly, if you haven't ever read any of it, listener, or, you know, the three fellas that I'm recording with today. It really is not a comic book about war so much as it is a comic about refugees and the realities of living in a war zone. It definitely feels influenced by the situation, which is a hell of a euphemism to use, but the situation in Syria, because the comic didn't start publishing, I think, until 2011. That actually might be earlier than that, so I could be wrong. But it's definitely extrapolating about, oh gosh, it's even earlier than that. It actually ran from 05 to 2012, so my bad there. Probably taking more inspiration from the Iraq War than anything else. But it definitely looks at the realities of modern history and modern war zones and transposes that to the island of Manhattan and kind of looks at things. Again, we start with a member of the press to kind of explore things and give exposition, but I think the strength of that comic, and hopefully in its TV adaptation, we'll explore this as well. It gets a lot more nebulous, and the web of characters and concerns gets wider, much like something like the bridge. And I think hopefully when we look at a border, even if we're only, you know, operating with 2-hour runtime, if we're trying to tell a story about where two nations rub up against each other and create, an unsurprising amount of friction, the story should have nuance. The story should try to examine things from a couple of different perspectives, at least, just by virtue of the fact that there are going to be at least two sides to the story, by virtue of the border. But of course, there's going to be so much more to look at beyond that, right? Because there's, depending on what kind of story you're looking at, there's either the law enforcement angle, there's the military angle, there's the diplomatic and political and civilian, et cetera, and all the way down. So that's the class. I hope we can learn something together.
Excellent. I would be interested in taking that class, Dalton. Well done, my friend. So I'm going to go to you next, Caleb. If you were going to expand the syllabus, what would you pair with this film, either readings or viewings, and what kind of class might you teach with joint security area?
Okay, so strap in. We're going to take the class From Patriotism to Pacifism, Repairing the Damaging Psychology of War Films. Okay, and we're going to start first open the gate assignment. I'm going to ask students to pick one. You need to pick The Patriot. You need to pick Pearl Harbor, you need to pick Air Force One, or you need to pick Black Hawk Down. And you need to write a paper on how this movie favors the American perspective at the cost of the humanity of the people they are fighting in the film. So trying to, you know, pick the movies that are a little more jingoistic, at least on their face, and then move on to from there, going to like another heavy hitter. Could be Apocalypse Now, Saving Private Ryan, or even Full Metal Jacket. And the idea there is really taking a look at movies that at least attempt to display more honest portrayals of war on a larger scale. In this particular, I would say, set of films, what you're looking at, that again, the horrors of war, I would also throw out an optional assignment, maybe extra credit, if you will, where students could go watch Restrepo from 2010, which is basically a documentary about actual war, like real bullets, real people die in the film. It's pretty intense. So I wouldn't actually ask someone to watch that if they weren't comfortable, but it is, you're just looking at like the actual human cost of war. I think that's one to at least consider. And then move on to a doubleheader. Now hear me out. Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. Now, whether or not I care for Clint Eastwood's politics in any capacity, I do think that this could be at least an interesting assignment or experiment for people who maybe haven't considered the quote-unquote enemy perspective of war. So minimally, the idea with this particular pairing would be to actually have people look at both sides, like, hey, here's the same conflict. Here's what it looks like from this perspective and this perspective. So what can we find and identify that is common and different? And how could this sort of thing have been avoided or handled differently? Next, you move on to... So we've gone through all the heavy hitters on war. So war is bad. I know. We all know this. This is very bad. It's very horrific. But I actually want to shift gears here and move on to something maybe a little bit more hopeful. So I want to then assign... I'm going to say this very wrong. All the people who speak French out there, you can laugh at me. I want to watch 2005's Joyeux, which is also Joyeux Noël. I can't remember how people read it, but it is a film from, I believe, 2005. It's a film that depicts the Christmas of 1914, where a number of German, British, and French soldiers made temporarily peace to celebrate Christmas evening together. And I think they went through like Boxing Day based on actual history. And the thing I want to highlight here is that, you know, despite war and the horrors of war and the cost of war, people actually have things in common. Christmas being a really mostly universal holiday, even for those who don't practice or don't follow the Christian tradition, it's just you know, a holiday that is well known and celebrated across the world in most respects. And this is actually where this next section is where I would put Joint Security Area in. So it's actually towards the end of the class. And what I'd want to highlight here without being too spoilery is just the humanity of those you are fighting. We see that a little bit with Joyeux. You're able to really dive into the relationship aspect. These are not people who have a one night truce. These are people who actually get to know each other on a very personal level, build real relationships, and find the humanity in those they are supposed to hate for one reason or another. And then I think I would close out the course by trying to be a little more hopeful by focusing on the healing aspects. So these are soldiers who have at one point been at odds with each other or maybe even tried to kill each other. But they have developed either a sense of forgiveness or camaraderie among those enemy soldiers. So I want to throw out 2013's lesser known Colin Firth film, The Railway Man, which is actually based on an actual autobiography. Essentially, this is where a British soldier was at one point captures a POW and tortured by a Japanese soldier who 30 years later finds out that said Japanese soldier was often not. There was no sort of he wasn't charged with any war crimes, and goes to seek out vengeance against this particular soldier, and it goes a little differently and ends on a mostly positive note. So that would be my class, again, from patriotism to pacifism.
Excellent.
What was that last one? The Railway Man?
The Railway Man. Yes. Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, no, it's actually really good. It has a couple. So it's got Colin Firth. It's got forgive me. There's a
Kidman's in it. Skarsgård's in it. Holy Skarsgård. Shit!
And it's got the it's a Japanese actor I really, really like is in it. He's in a bunch of television shows, Lost, and I believe he was in Avengers: Endgame. So yeah, I'm totally drawing a blank on his name, but yeah, it's a good cast.
Outstanding. Yeah, I would be up for that indeed, indeed. Well, hey, Arthur, what class would you offer using Joint Security Area?
I just want to real quick say that when Caleb mentioned the Railway Man, I thought he said Colin Farrell at first, which is a drastically different movie.
Accurate.
If I apologize if I was incorrect. It's Colin Firth. Yes.
I think you did say Firth, but in my head I heard Farrell. I was picturing a much different movie because I remember the trailers for that and I never got to see it, but I was always intrigued because it's an interesting premise. So for my class, I think I want to take a look at procedurals, storytelling, and really kind of dive into that. I highlighted it a bit when we talked about searching, but I really want to get into that and talk about that kind of, you know, by the numbers storytelling of following whatever it is. It's kind of oftentimes some mundanity. We see a lot of police procedurals, though, which kind of are able to ramp up the stakes because murder is involved and there's a killer, which automatically enhances the stakes. But oftentimes procedural is just a very mundane, routine type of story. You know, anything kind of day in the life of X career can become a procedural. And so I want to look at that. And so I've actually got some TV procedurals and movies I would pair with them, I think. And that's kind of how we'd work this course and taking a look at how the procedural has evolved over time, as well as how these movies kind of take elements from procedurals and embellish or establish or play with them in a way. So that's what I want to do with this. So I'm going to start, though, with 1957's OG Perry Mason with Raymond Burr. And really get into the court movie and the court story and trials and TV and stuff, and talk about this iconic character of pop culture, especially at the time. And with that Raymond Burr thread, I actually want to go back to 1954, and I want to take a look at Rear Window, because Rear Window is a piece of a procedural that is then stretched out to an entire movie, and that's the third act. Rear Window is the entire, you know, basement scene from Silence of the Lambs brought to one movie. It's like if that sequence was the entire movie. And so I think there's an interesting dichotomy there, and Raymond Burr in 1954 playing the villain versus Raymond Burr in 57 playing Perry Mason. I want to talk about that kind of casting choice. I think that's really interesting as well. So I want to start there, and then I'm going to move a few years ahead. I want to talk about Columbo, because you got to talk about Columbo. You know, talk about Peter Falk and these TV movies that he was doing as Columbo, and the iconic character that the way he was able to kind of play against type of a lot of TV detectives and film detectives. And with that, I want to take a look at Diabolique, which has a very similar Columbo character in it. And it's also a mystery where you have all the pieces, but the story is not connecting, which reminds me a bit of Joint Security Area in the way that it plays with that narrative and the mystery and the information given and withheld and how that completely alters things and the way they play out. From there, I want to go back to Searching, and I actually want to take a look at The Show Without a Trace. This is a more modern procedural about missing persons, and they all have that kind of setup. It's been, you know, 37 hours since the person went missing. We've got to find them. It's got a great cast, and it's very modern in its sensibilities. If you've seen any, you know, current TV procedural, you've seen Without a Trace. I mean, they all have that same kind of through line. But I think pairing that with Searching and talking about how Searching takes the mundanity of the procedural and is able to amplify it in certain ways by using that screen capture thing, technique, and also placing the investigation in the hands of the common man and the father, the grieving father. I think those are interesting dichotomies in comparison with Without a Trace. Beyond that, I want to go in and I want to pair Psych with The Gift, a movie we watched a long time ago. But I want to talk about, you know, the idea, the kind of comedy of Psych, and the idea of psychic investigation and elements of that in The Gift, and how we've got Cate Blanchett, who actually sees ghosts, and kind of the juxtaposition of those two ideas, I think is a lot of fun, just pairing those together. And then we got to get some camp in there. We got to have some silliness. And so I want to talk about Fox's, now Netflix's, Lucifer, and really dive into that silly supernaturalishness of the procedural and how goofy you can get with it. And with that movie or show, I want to pair the movie Fallen with Denzel and John Goodman, which we also talked about a long time ago. Which gets to take the procedural and kind of flip it on its head because of the unreliable narrator element. And I like that as well. And not knowing who to trust or whose story to believe, I think is fun. And then with Joint Security Area, I would pair it with NCIS. I think you go with a modern classic of TV procedurals, specifically with NCIS, because then you can get into the military elements. NCIS is all about the naval crimes and the kind of red tape bureaucracy that goes into investigating not just a crime, but a military crime, which has a much, you know, different dynamic involved with a lot more, I think, red tape involved in a lot of ways, at least the way it's presented in TV and film, and talking that with Joint Security Area. And that's where I would go with this course.
Outstanding, outstanding. Very, very good. And I mean, I think that is a kind of an area that does not get a lot of investigation because it is sort of treated as disposable entertainment, right? And there's something to be had there. And I think you're doing a good job of diving into it.
You can say disposable, but then ask Mark Harmon's Boathouse about it, you know?
Right.
People like him.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, for sure. So, well, if I was going to be teaching a class, I think I would make this a module in some class. I mean, the class could be unusual or less examined TV tropes or film tropes, I should say. Mm. And I guess this would be a few good star-crossed lovers is what I might do with this. And the idea being that this is sort of a doomed relationship, this friendship between our soldiers north and south. And there's no way that it cannot end badly. And the ways in which those kinds of stories are used for various political or sociological ends. Obviously, this one is sort of trying to interrogate the rift, as Dalton put it, the wound between the division of the North and South. And I think that is a fascinating place to begin with. And that would roll all the way back to the year 1946 and look at a little MGM joint called The Yearling. I don't know if either or any of y'all have seen The Yearling or are aware of this film, but it's a Gregory Peck film. But it's a child coming of age film. Think Old Yeller, but with a deer.
I read The Yearling.
Okay,
I was like, is this the one with the deer? It is.
Yeah,
okay. I don't think I saw the movie.
Yeah.
I don't want to think Old Yeller.
Say what?
I don't want to think Old Yeller.
Yeah, well, it is Old Yeller, but with a deer. And so the boy.
That's almost worse. Hold on.
Bambi does
the deer get rabies?
The deer does not get rabies. The deer tries to eat the cornfield.
Well, that's better than the people.
And it is their means of sustenance and of, you know, commercial viability. And so stepmom, who is not cottoning well to new stepson, who has recently married Gregory Peck, is forced to shoot at the deer. And because she's a girl and girls are bad shots, don't give a firearm to a female. She accidentally wounds the deer, and our little boy is forced to finish the job and put him down. But in the film's denouement, stepmom is now more able to show love to the son. And in some ways, they're drawn closer through the trauma of the loss of this inseparable friendship between a boy and his deer.
Now, Dustin, did you just say something tragic? Because all I heard was Arthur talking, and I just started writing about the man-eating deer. Was I supposed to do that?
No, there is no man-eating deer. It is tragic.
Oh, okay, all right. I guess I'll throw this page of notes away.
And
don't throw it away. There's a script idea there, Dalton. I'm ready to see that movie.
And tragic in the way in which a traumatic loss of a childhood pet is somehow really okay as long as it, you know, sustains the continuity of the American nuclear family. But also complicated the fact that Gregory Peck's character is a Confederate Civil War veteran as well. So it's sort of an Old West homestead kind of story. for that. Flashing forward to the year of our Lord 1981, let's do an animated thing because Disney does have a good take, or an interesting take. I wouldn't say good take on this, and I want to talk about The Fox and the Hound.
Yeah.
And so Kurt Russell is one of the voices in this film, and which is just a fun fact for you all, as he began his career working for the House of Mouse there at Disney. And the Fox and the Hound is probably well known, well watched by our various co-hosts and listeners all over the world. But I think that idea of this friendship, and that friendship triumphs over all, it's got this sort of victorious kind of overcoming kind of thing. Obviously, there are racialized tones that also speak to some of the dynamics between our fox and our hound, Cooper, and I forget the hound or the fox's name. Nope, it's not going to come back, and it doesn't even matter. But that is what I would do with that. And then number third, finally and lastly, before we get to joint security area, the boy in the striped pajamas. Because you know what? What we need now is a little more sadness. I don't know if you're familiar with The Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
Did you find The Fox and the Hound to be too uplifting?
Well, I like how Dustin painted it as uplifting and then went on to The Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
Yeah. Comparatively speaking, I would believe that it is.
That's fair.
The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, with a Y, not a or a pajamas, P-Y jammas. I don't know why that spelling is always variable and all over the place. But anyway, it is a friendship. There's a hole in the fence of a concentration camp next door to a German farm. A little German boy makes friends with a boy in the striped pajamas across the fence. They become pally-wallies. And of course, this friendship is doomed. And he follows the little boy into the concentration camp on shower gas chamber day. And they both end up very dead. It's... I mean, we're making light of it. It is a desperately sad story. But
never before has the Shoah come up on this show before with such laughter.
I know. But here's the thing. The filmmakers and the filmmaking is using this to sort of, in a different kind of way, as like, it's not trying to rehabilitate Nazism. Yeah,
it's not the Life is Beautiful problem, right?
No. What ends up happening is there are bystanders on the German side that are also not aware of this. And there's sort of a childhood innocence thing that this plays into as well. But this idea of others get caught up in the rolling machine of exclusionary genocidal politics. And that is a fascinating take and interesting way to invest oneself in it, then moving ourselves on into joint security area, where again, various political machinations have created a somewhat artificial set of rifts. And yet those artificial set rifts, they're not artificial in the sense that they're not real, but they're virtual and they have a real dynamic influence on self-understanding and the understanding of others, and require of us to behave in certain kinds of ways. So that was much more of a chuckle fest than I anticipated. with
everybody couldn't get over your good joke.
I was totally by accident. So there you go, dear listener. Your syllabus just got extraordinarily longer and perhaps sadder. Though I think it's now definitely time.
Yeah, well, between Caleb and I, there are at least two movies in which people actually die, which totally sucks. It is a hard, big ass bummer to watch.
Yeah. Oh man, dude. Let's get down to business.
I didn't make Restrepo.
That's right, Restrepo did make the list today, on top of The Fox and the Hound and The Boy and the Shrimp.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Let's talk about the murder mystery, please.
Yes, indeed. Let's get down to business. Here's the music now. That's right, dear listener, and we are back. Thank heavens. And we are perhaps cool, calm, and collected, ready with objective and clinical precision to do some analysis of this film.
Should I not ask my question about whether or not the sticky pages is a cum joke then, if we're supposed to be clinical and academic now?
I don't think you should not ask it, because I think that is exactly what it is.
Okay, that means I'm good at film analysis, I think, right?
Yeah.
Well, jury's out on that one.
Hey, can we talk about how it's cool that a murder mystery just, like, lets the whole middle be about relationships?
I mean, yeah. For sure.
I love that. Like, I can't think of another movie that does this. I was trying to think, and like, the closest I could come to was Gone Girl, which kind of has, like, a similar, you know, midpoint digression, where we kind of recontextualize everything that's happened so far.
Well, the realm of Twin Peaks, I think, plays this out, too.
Okay.
There's a suggestion on the internet that David Lynch's central thesis is that if you simply make it into a procedural, right, the murder victim becomes uninteresting. And in fact, all the other characters kind of become uninterested in that character. And it's not really about who they were and what they were about and what they loved and what they dreamed, but rather how is it possible that the door was locked from the inside? Ah, right. That's all that we care about. Yeah. And the way in which that show continued to simply just explore the various characters' relationships with Laura Palmer is what the strength of the show was through its original first two seasons. Well, 2.5 seasons, until ABC forced them to go ahead and solve the mystery, and then nobody cared anymore. Right. So I think that would be a close place to that. And I think this film does a pretty good job.
Well, I was going to say, we talked about that pretty lengthy. I think it was when we discussed Searching and we kind of started getting into the ethics of the serial killer stuff. But we brought up, I think, in that conversation, the idea of so many murder mysteries are more focused on A, the murder, and then B, the investigation, without really investigating who the victim was. And I think we discussed Twin Peaks then as well, because you're right. It usually doesn't let us get so into this world of the victim. We're so wrapped up in how did it happen and not who was this person and what did they mean.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a somewhat nameless character, it appears, with the guy who catches them finally there and brings about that final conflict. He is just some rando North Korean officer.
Yeah, the order-following lieutenant. Who we
I was going to say,
we know he's a prick. That's about all we got, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, he's established.
Well, and even that is kind of suspect, right? Because we don't know what he was going to do when he reached for his radio, right? And that is kind of the great unknown tragedy of the kind of end stages of this movie, I think, is the situation gets de-escalated and then immediately re-escalates, because you can't ever know what's in somebody else's mind unless you're
right.
Paul Muad'Dib. I finished Dune, by the way. Keithan told me he liked my Dune digression during Life of Brian, so I feel like I owed it to him to bring up Dune this episode. Thanks
well,
for the
it was
Patreon.
More appropriate there, probably.
Yeah, probably.
But to an extent, though, definitely Officer MacGuffin shows up as, his role as plot contrivance.
Totally.
And, yeah.
I mean, I do really like I do really appreciate, though, that I mean, and that's what really struck me and took me off guard, was I really did feel like this was going to be pretty procedural, even for like the first 25 minutes, until I get to that lengthy flashback that makes up most of the second act of the film. And it's because like these procedurals that we watch on TV, whether it's crime shows, whether whether it's a war movie, whether it's A Few Good Men, like the things that you're breaking down are there is a human element that is often left on the table or boiled down to one or two really simple things, where I feel like we really get to see the nuance behind, hey, here's a conflict that occurred. These are real people. They had real lives. Here's their allegiances. Here's the doubts they had about their belief system that they were still following. So I think it makes it a lot muddier, which is really much more compelling, at least
to me. And to bring up, like, even outside of, like, just thematic stuff, like, that which is on screen in this movie, right? Arthur's already talked about the autopsy sequence. There's a lot of Park Chan-wook's kind of violent subversiveness, obviously, Old Boy and Mr. Vengeance, like these kind of more operatic films are more gross in their violence. But this film is very graphic in a way that is grounded. And I think the groundedness makes it that much more upsetting. That autopsy is tragic because we see the family like watching the autopsy and listen to them cry like periodically throughout the proceedings. And again, as Arthur said, like it doesn't shy away from the realities of rigor mortis. Like they're just kind of flopping them around like puppets because That's how you examine a dead body.
Who lets the family in the watch, the viewing room, while the examination is going on?
I don't know about the rules, you know, over there. Who can be sure if that's a movie contrivance or not? But yeah, it does seem like a poor judgment on somebody's part. But even outside the autopsy, right? Like, the actual shooting is quite graphic and yep. upsetting in this. It's not a movie shootout, right? Like, it is a... When people get shot, it's gross, and it makes a huge damn mess.
Well, you see the guy's thumb get blown off, which I feel like wasn't something you've seen very often in a shootout.
So specific, right? Like, yeah, there's the gross headshot, but yeah, you're right. The thumb thing is so much more specific, and I know I mentioned this already towards the top of the show, but the owl just kind of, I like it when animals see humans doing dumb things. I like Eye of God stuff in movies. It's cool. I'm a sucker, but yeah, the shafts of light like coming out through the bullet holes in their little shed, and the recurring owl that we get a couple of times, a couple of different versions of the flashback. Like, I love all of that stuff, and I like that. Again, as everybody's already alluded to, Park Chan-wook kind of like knows how this is a procedural and wants to work against that as much as possible.
Absolutely. So shall we talk a little bit about just the sort of impossibility of the relationship and what political, if any, and I don't really have a lot to say about this.
I've got something. Yeah. I thought about Hideo Kojima. Caleb already talked about this.
Yes.
The sort of with what was the French movie that you didn't want to mess around with the pronunciation. Yeah, I've heard of that movie. And I think there's actually might be another movie about that same incident, or at least inspired by it. But yeah, I there's this idea running throughout the Metal Gear Solid franchise and a couple of other probably more smart sounding works. Just this idea that soldiers have more loyalty to each other as working class murder commandos than they do to the governments they work for. There is more in common among the rank and file in the NCOs than there are with any officer or any head of state, right? And I think this film does touch on that a little bit, right? This sort of class consciousness of soldiering, and there is obviously the differences between South Korean service versus North Korean service are explored, right? Song Kang-ho's character is like, wait, what? You're about to discharge out and you've only been in for 2.5 years? What the hell?
Right.
This guy's like a 13-year in commando who almost lost an eye in Libya allegedly. And again, I kind of like that the film doesn't tease out whether or not that's like just soldier myth making or if that information is really true. But I think that is the thing that bonds these characters from the top. And I think is the thing that kind of allows them to keep being friends. It's just like, they like soldiering because they are, for all that all the boredom of sitting at that border, they like playing dress up. They like going on maneuvers, they are enjoying it for whatever it's worth. And I think that camaraderie across borders and across ideologies is really interesting.
Well, and I did butt kicking contests and what have you.
Yeah, of course.
Well, and one thing I want to add on to there, Dalton, is like the only reason this occurs is it's purely on the context of their meeting. Had they met on the battlefield, they absolutely totally would have shot at each other. But like they didn't meet on
the
battlefield.
Do.
Exactly. But whenever it's a more human moment, like, hey, I'm on a landmine, I'm crying because I think if I'm going to die, could you help me? You know what I mean? Like, it's just a very human moment that, to your point, because they're soldiers and have probably seen people blown up by mines before, or at least heard of it or had friends who've had that happen too, they're able to really empathize in that moment. And because they kind of crack that door of empathy open in that moment, they're able to like start talking about all sorts of other things. So it's just like one of those things where you say, what if, outside of the battlefield, you could have just honest human moments with other people? What does that look like? And could that be the path forward to maybe resolving some of these issues, or is just the nationalism on both sides too strong? And I think the movie actually lands more on the former. I mean, because they ultimately are trying to protect one another over their country. At least that was my take.
And I think it's important to keep in mind, like, the dream of both of these armed forces is a unified Korea, which I think is very interesting. If you like look into like what their deal is as far as like inter-soldier camaraderie and like their esprit de corps type stuff, like both armies are preach a unified Korea. And I think that's maybe the most overtly political thing we get is when Song Kang-ho's character, Sergeant Kyung-pil, he talks about, like, what do you think is really going to happen? If the war starts back up, this is just going to be an irradiated peninsula. America's going to nuke all of us. Like, you dipshits, don't you see? They don't really care about any of us. And I think that is really the most, the closest the movie dips its toes into, like, having an overt political take is just kind of a frustration with the status quo at the DMZ. Is the feeling of the two Koreas being played as pawns in a larger multinational struggle, which I think, you know, we talked about The Host last year, and that film gets into some of those ideas a little bit. But I think it's interesting to have a character just kind of go ahead and state clearly, and again, the character that would be considered in a more conventional film to be the potential villain, right? The South Korean sergeant who's willing to lie to preserve the status quo. Is a guy that does understand the status quo is no good, but also knows that there's no way to, like, fix that overnight.
Right. I do want to point out sort of a missed opportunity, as we mentioned, one of the major sort of plot moments, which is the disarming of the landmine. The sort of, like, I had a Chekhov's gun kind of expectation that landmines would go ahead and play a particular kind of role, because I don't know if you guys are aware of this or not. But there have been a number of landmine treaties proposed over the last few decades to total disarmament. And they've been sponsored many times by the U.S., but not always, the United States has not gone ahead and been a partner in those particular treaties, because they would not make an exception for the DMZ. And the continued policy and posture of United States foreign policy is to continue to keep the DMZ mined to prevent North incursions into the South. And so, again, that sort of unilateral external kind of force at work is something that the film seems to be really cognizant of. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's a real missed opportunity to speak to. But
no, I'd say that's fair. The only kind of real overture back towards, other than, you know, the kind of monologue that I referenced, is, I guess, the ineffectualness of the, it's a real organization, and thankfully we're not involved in it. The Neutral Nations Supervisory Committee.
Oh, is it not just the UN in different garb?
No, it's Sweden, Switzerland, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. It was set up in 1953. I mean, we don't need to get in the history of this, but my understanding is that it is operated independently of the United Nations. It's just, I don't know why Sweden and Switzerland got Czechoslovakia and Poland on board, but again, because of their neutrality during World War II, I assume that's why they were brought in to oversee this. But
since is no more Czechoslovakia, is the Czech Republic involved, or...
I can assume it's probably the Czech Republic took its place, but at the very least when it was founded, the now Czech Republic would have been involved with it. I didn't do a ton of research into it. Yeah, I was curious just to be like, is this a real thing that they're referencing? Is this a movie convention? And again, it does exist in some respects. And yes, Dustin, to answer your question, the Czech Republic is now involved in it as well. They had some sort of 60th anniversary in 2013 at the Czech embassy in South Korea, apparently.
Interesting. I did find the little fun fact about the number of communists and anti-communists that were captured in the South Korean prisoner of war camps, that there were a number who did not wish to go back to either country after the armistice was declared. And I was fascinated by that, and I found that to be an interesting sort of parentage for our Major Sophie. I don't know anything about, again, this. This was the first time I'd ever heard of that.
I didn't look very hard, to be fair, but I wasn't able to find any real history on that. But I certainly hope, if that's real, there are more works, both narrative and both fictional and nonfiction that explore that. Because you're right, it's a very interesting idea.
Well, I think it's fascinating because it does sort of propose a third way, right? Mm. And so, again, the movie sort of gestures that way. It doesn't do anything with it, but it is definitely by including that in the narrative, by that sort of long reveal that her father was a North Korean general who just decided not to go home after being captured in the war, that would propose that there are some other possibilities for some kind of future than simply the North or the South finally winning to unify through pacification through a power, right?
To that point of unifying, do we think this is going to be asking a lot of us? So if nobody has anything here, that's totally fine. It's just something I was thinking about. Is there, as you said, Dustin, the film does, or just said rather, the films, you know, make some overtures towards this potential third way. But is there a real like political aim at work in this movie? And of course, you know, the screenplay is not Park Chan-wook joint. There's like four credited people working on it. So, you know, any larger message is a group message if there is one, right? But is there a point here? Because we can assume that, you know, most North Koreans are probably never going to see this movie. If a North Korean does see this movie, it will probably be somebody, a border guard at the DMZ, right? Because they're the one that's going to get it dropped on their head. But, like, what is the purpose of this? I like and appreciate that we don't really make a fool of the North Korean officer, or not officers. I think Song Kang-ho's character is a sergeant, right? And then I think the other guy's a private. But anyway, it doesn't make fun of them too much. They like, you know, they seem a little homeschooled, for lack of a better way to put it. but I think outside of that, it doesn't really like make fun of them, right? It doesn't have too much fun at their expense. And I think that's really important for this to feel, for all the themes we've already discussed, to feel sincere and to feel earnest. You've got to like give these guys some real character and can't like have too many jokes at their expense. I'm just curious, like, because there's just these brief couple of overtly political moments, do we think that it is just the film acknowledging its role as, you know, taking place in the real world in some ways, or do we think there's like a real purpose here at all? Because we kind of speculated about it potentially being a sort of propagandistic last week when we teed up that this was our next show we'd be doing.
I don't get a strong sense that it is.
I don't either. Yeah, because in any way,
it feels like it gestures towards there ought to be something in this kind of a mess. War, huh? What is it good for? Absolutely nothing, right? and just sort of leaving it there. And I think that is part of why I don't feel warmer about the movie, is that it doesn't go ahead and make something of a political stance. It simply is
interesting.
You know, it kind of falls into a strange Driving Miss Daisy kind of realm.
I gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, it finally resolves to say, well, you know what, this was a murder procedural all along, so we don't really have to have a larger point. We mentioned that how we feel about this, and we can move on.
Yeah,
I mean, I wouldn't say I felt like it had the point was, and again, I think this kind of circles back to something that Dustin's been sort of saying here, which is the points it's making aren't exactly like original thoughts or notions. I do find the context of the North Korea, South Korea, you know, the idea that, hey, these people we're fighting are actually not communist monsters, XYZ, because, you know, this is totally geared at South Koreans. I don't think that it's not particularly revelatory. It's been said to death in tons of other war movies and war procedural movies. But I think in the context of South Korea, maybe this was a particularly relevant like idea that they because I do think, Dalton, it wasn't lost on me that they actually took the North Koreans very seriously, whereas in a lot of South Korean and even American films, we super do not take North Korea seriously at all. There was a great deal of respect shown to those characters, and I think it was because if they had made fun of them, then you couldn't have taken the relationship seriously.
Totally. You actually just said something that reminded me of a very small formal element I wanted to bring up, and it's not even a thing within the film. It's like a localization feature. At one point, we get a little subtitle explaining who is in Nam's wallet, and it's some, you know, big movie star in South Korea.
Right.
And Caleb, I'm glad you kind of alluded to, like, there are probably some just cultural specificities that are going to be lost on us, right? They're, you know, a word choice, right, that might reveal more in the original language that we're not going to be able to get, you know, some nuance that we might not get to pick up on just because we're outsiders looking in. But there is that really wonderful, like, little bit of localization, and I truly wish every movie did that. Like, if there's a pop culture joke, if there is a, you know, a cultural or religious nuance that I'm not gonna pick up as a, you know, a foreigner, I love it when the subtitles like also have little localization like that. That's great. I wish more movies did it.
I did have a different reading of that moment, though, insofar as him having a fake girlfriend and him making the comment.
I read that as a fake girlfriend, yeah.
Well, and the comment that he makes to his buddy that he's quite handsome, I read Nam as gay.
I did too, yeah, okay. Absolutely. I was saying that localization feature was so important. Sorry, I didn't tease that out well enough, I'm realizing. Yeah, Nam definitely reads that way to me, especially like the sort of there's some insinuations throughout the film, I think, and I just was reading a little bit about queer cinema in Korea and how it is just within 2000 at that point it would have still mostly been a an indie art house feature, right? There wasn't really a lot of mainstream Korean cinema representation of the queer community, but yeah, definitely read that way. The fake girlfriend likely. The sort of stolen glances and stuff. Yeah, I got that out of that as well. And it definitely colored sort of the violence of the murder that Nam commits in some ways, I feel like. I don't know. That might be me reaching a little bit, but it definitely feels like the movie's got something that it's wanting to say there.
Yeah, well, again, it seems like there is something really interesting that we could play with here as far as something thematic, but it is simply just another shade of character, which is not bad all by itself. It doesn't be, every movie with gay representation doesn't have to be like a gay movie and all, all caps and italics and sparkles. Yeah. But that being said, I kind of wanted more to be done with it.
And yeah, I'm curious.
Continued frustration I continue to have. Yeah,
I mean, obviously, at that time, our military still had a "don't ask, don't tell" situation going on. So I'm curious what the situation the South Korean armed services would have been. I imagine not much better, if at all. It's an interesting kind of moment of character, and you're right. Like we don't need to underline every moment of character nuance in every film, but I thought it's kind of a nice small moment, and again, just like the way some of those details get explained to us, I think are really cool. And I wish that was a feature of translation and subtitles more, was that just those little small bits of localization to kind of help you understand some nuances you might otherwise miss.
Yeah, I agree with that. Are there any other big thoughts or areas of analysis that you guys want to explore with this film before we render a verdict?
I think the only thing I would throw out there, and I don't know if this is like a fully realized like idea that's a deep dive, but I did find so against like that sort of twist that you thought the movie was going to be a procedural investigation, but actually it's a story about these characters. The thing I found particularly compelling about that middle section is, for me, it turned from a mystery to a suspense. Where I don't know, totally. It was pretty conclusive about generally what happened. Obviously, who shot first, some of the smaller details were still kind of up for question. But like it turned from who killed who to, oh my gosh, how is this going to fall apart? Like what's the context? Is someone going to say something? Like, and it actually still ended up like playing out much differently than even I had anticipated. So I just want to call that out because I found the suspense to be pretty impressive. And I think that's something that throughout his body of work, whether or not it's sort of like the more stylish thing that Arthur referenced earlier, or the more sort of like over the top, convoluted, self-indulgent Park Chan-wook, I think it's one of the strongest tools in his tool set. And I think it was deployed really, really well here about like, oh my gosh, we know this is going to fall apart. We know generally what's going to happen. What is the context, especially what's the tension in the relationships going to be like, and how is it going to play out specifically? I found that to be just really, really compelling. I don't know. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think like Dustin was talking about, right, this sort of online interpretation of Twin Peaks about trying to take a procedural and make it be about people. I think it absolutely, letting the focus of the film shift and letting it stop being a thriller or a mystery, it starts to become a tragedy. We start to get to know these guys and know that the shit's about to hit the fan, right? It gets to do the Romeo and Juliet or the Iliad thing, right? It gets to be a tragedy with a foregone conclusion, and now you are forced to watch the bad thing that you know is going to happen unfold. I love that kind of stuff, and I think the film like is vested enough in this story that it lets, again, a lot of that context happens as we're watch as Lee Byung-hung, is that his name? The guy that was also that's been in some American movies. I think he was Storm Shadow in the G.I. Joe movies. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Sergeant Lee, who's also played by a man named Lee, as he watches Nam like plummet to what seems like a certain death, like all of this flashback plays out in that small moment. And it totally did not occur to me as this flashback unfolds, because it is such a long sequence that we were going to cut back to that moment happening. I was like, oh crap, okay, we're back here. All right. And it definitely, like, again, it allows, because that moment is so tragic and so upsetting, it really lets the movie breathe. And I think that's one of the strengths of the film. And as we alluded to in our marathon last year, I think one of the strengths of South Korean cinema in general is it is more willing to be slow when it needs to be than American cinema is. There are not, especially in the early 2000s, you'd not have a lot of U.S. Big budget movies like taking time to let somebody wash their face like we get in this film, right? Or to really let moments breathe, or to have a hour-long flashback sequence to give more context for this tragedy that's unfolding. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Caleb. Like, it totally changes the movie for the better and allows it to be about something other than a whodunit or a whydunit.
I think it's one of those things, you know, obviously I think Park is a fan of Hitchcock, and he gets to do his own Hitchcock movie later with Stoker. And so I think, obviously, a lot of that probably comes from there. And then the way, to your point, Dalton, the way he is able to invest that into emotional relationships, this kind of emotional suspense. When does this, you know, as we see what's unfolding and realize what's blossoming, it really does become, you know, when does the tragedy occur?
Totally.
And so I think, you know, Caleb, I think you're right. I think it's a fascinating way for them to sort of pull the rug in a way that we're familiar with, but also not super comfortable with in a narrative structure. I think it works very well. I think that middle part of the film is, you know, it's what we keep coming back to, and I think it's the highlight of the movie, as that's where a lot of our subversion to normal tropes comes, and it works really well. And even in the little things like the minefield that you know, Dustin already mentioned that, but that sequence, like, I know in the beginning they set up, you know, that he's like this hero, and you know, he went and disabled a landmine by himself, and he did all these like great things, and we get to kind of see, you know, he threw a rock through their window, and we get to see the behind the scenes on all those stories, which is a fun bit. But even as and seeing that kind of unfold when he steps on that mine, and I knew that was in the past, but I was still like on the edge of my seat, like, how's he getting out of this mess, you know? So I think even in those little moments, that the way Park is playing with suspense, as far as subverting it or stretching it out, or including it in different relationships or emotional beats, is really well done and well orchestrated.
No, I think so too. Absolutely, well done all. Let's go ahead and move now to render a verdict then on this film. So what do we say, shelf or trash? I go to you first, Caleb. What do you say, buddy?
It's a no-brainer for me. This is a shelfer. Again, maybe it's because I went in with zero context about what I was about to watch, other than like the director, or I just found myself really in love with the character relationships. It's definitely one that I'll go back to in the future, so I would love to put it on my shelf.
All right. Well, what do you say, Dalton?
Yeah, no, I think I might have undersold how much I like this movie earlier by being kind of in my review, by just kind of giving it a, it's fine, but I it's a real, you know, gentleman's four, like out of five. It's very solid. I you know, even though it didn't like change my world, I am struck by the craft and the character building. And as Arthur said, like, I like this volume on Park Chan-wook, right? Like, I like Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, but that movie is a bummer and really hard to watch. This is obviously still, you know, not a happy film, but I think it's, I don't know, there is more humanity on display in that film. It's not a total race to the bottom on who can, you know, become the biggest monster the quickest. And I appreciate that. Yeah, it's there's a lot going on, and it's the simplicity of the central premise, I think, belies like what's really going on in this film. So yeah, it's absolutely a shelfable movie.
All right. Thank you very much for that. What do you say, Arthur?
I think I will continue adding it to the shelf as well. I As I mentioned earlier on, this is the style of Park Chan-wook that I like, and I think it's a really good Song Kang-ho film as well. And so, if either of those things piques your interest, you know, if you were on board our Song of Praise marathon and want some more, I think this is a great entry into his filmography. It's a great entry into his career, very early on in his career, and very early for Park as well. We mentioned last week, I think this is only the third feature film he had done in 2000, and so I think it's worthy of a shelf.
All right. Well, thank you again for that all. I guess I'm going to be the odd man out today. I'm going to say stream it whenever it becomes available to stream again. I think it's very good. I think it's definitely a good time, but I don't think it's a movie that I would want to be able to come back to on demand. If it was available, if for some reason I was, you know, surfing through a search menu and saw it, I probably would watch it again. But barring that, I don't know that I would. I think it's good. I think it's very interesting. I think it's doing a lot of great things. But I think there are better Park Chan-wook movies. I think there are better Song Kang-ho movies. I think there's other stuff that I might be more interested in looking at and thinking about thematically even with this film. But that being said, that's not for me to say it's a bad film at all. I just don't think I would bother shelving it for me personally. So there you go, dear listener. Thanks again, Keithan, for your patronage on patreon.com and for making this recommend. I think we've had a great conversation with that. Before I throw over to Dalton for social media and whatnot for the Good Trash Network, Caleb, I want to throw over to you. Tell us about the things that you're making and where you can be found on the interwebs.
Hey, thanks, Dustin. And hey, big shout out to all three of you guys. Thanks so much for having me back on the show. It's been kind of a wild year, and I've just really missed having these sorts of conversations with good friends like you guys. So again, thanks for the invite to have me back on the genre cast today. People can find me doing all sorts of film-related content, currently a lot of interviews, some reviews over at thecinematropolis.com on my podcast, The Cinematic Schematic. We're on the tail end of our interview series, three films that got you through the 2020 pandemic, and of course had the great pleasure to have both Dalton and Arthur on a few weeks ago. We've got a couple more. I think Steven Tyler down from Tower Theater here in Oklahoma City is scheduled to be up next week, followed by I've got a couple other interviews I'm really excited to announce here the next week or so. So anyway, you can check that out there. We have a Godzilla versus Kong review that just came out this past week. Hope you'll check it out there. You can find me tweeting about all the things on Twitter at C Masters Talk. That is letter C Masters Talk. And again, the website is thecinematropolis.com.
Very cool. Very cool. Go follow Caleb and find out all the cool things he's doing there. Hey, Dalton, how can they find out about the cool things we're doing?
Oh, you know, turn on your computer, old man. That's how. It sounds like a user error. Other things that sound sassy. If you want to send us an email, you really want to give us 3,000 words on how you think it's weird we never brought up that they built a whole set of the DMZ since they obviously couldn't film there. You can send that email to goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you know, you can. I wouldn't recommend you get on Twitter, but if you want to, it's good_trash. You can find all the things we're making, all the things our friends are making. You want to listen to people talk about contemporary Christian culture? Go listen to At the Praise Down, hosted by Heath and Alex. They were just on the show recently to discuss The Life of Brian with us. We had a fun time. And if you want to get more into their deal, go over there. Do you like Randy Newman? Who doesn't, right? You can check out The Wheel of Randy, hosted by Dan Wade. It's a fun show. They also just did Alex went on that show for the second time and stole it for a little bit to do The Wheel of Zappa. I haven't listened to it yet, but it sounds like a fun episode. I'm very excited to check it out. Anyway, all that and more at good_trash. That's on Twitter if you want to put that in your eyeballs. We're on the pod places. Yeah, Stitcher, you know it. You love it. Apple Medias. You can rate, review, subscribe. You've listened to a podcast before. I don't think we need to do more of this. If you want to be like Keithan, though, and pick movies we watch, you can go to patreon.com/GTM. I'm not going to, you know, do a soft shoe for you too hard right now. We're a little bit behind on bonus content. But if the idea of dictating the playlist of this podcast appeals to you, if there's a movie you're just champing at the bit to hear us talk about, it's patreon.com/GTM. I don't know what tier that is, but I know it's not too bad. I think they get to do it, what, once a year, Arthur, is that right? Quarterly? How often do they get to pick a movie?
Once a year?
once a year. That sounds right. I can't imagine we offered to do that more than once a year. That would be a lot. Yeah. Head over there. There's all kinds of fun things. You know, obviously we're behind on the bonus content, as I said, but you know, we might send you something. You like getting movies in the mail? I do. My wife's a patron because she's sweet like that. And Arthur just sent us a copy of Arrival not long ago. That's a movie I'm glad to own. I didn't already have it. Just a brief sampling of what you can expect over there. That's it for social medias. We're done. Arthur, can you tell us and the fine people at home what we're going to be watching and discussing next week?
Oh, I most certainly can.
Oh, you sound excited.
I had to call an audible while y'all were doing some analysis because the movie I was going to pick isn't streaming, I don't think. I don't know. It was weird. Just watches being funky with some of its stuff. Doesn't matter. Long story short, next week we are watching a movie that is celebrating 20 years of life. Almost to the date. It came out on April 22nd, 2001. I hope you all are ready to strap in because you're all stars. Because next week,
oh no,
we're watching Shrek.
We're getting Shrek 5. It's happening.
Nice.
Arthur's been threatening to do this to us for a while, and it's finally happened. We're getting a meme pilled.
That's all right. I will have a good time watching that movie. I think I own that movie somewhere. I might have to look around, see if I can locate it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go to my parents' house. I think there's a VHS copy of that lying around somewhere still.
Definitely watch it on VHS. I'll
just watch it on Hulu.
Oh, well, there's that too. That's probably easier than any of it.
Now, Arthur, can we expect a full treatise on the Shrek cinematic universe from you next week?
Hey, you never know what's going to happen.
You are a king of context. I'm always telling people.
Well, there you go, dear listener. You keep watching, and we'll keep talking Shrek next, and we'll see you all next time.